guys, welcome back to What's On Your Mind. I'm here today with Guy Kawasaki, the chief evangelist of Canva and the creator of Guy Kawasaki's Remarkable People podcast. He is an executive fellow of the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and an adjunct professor at the University of New South Wales. He was the chief evangelist of Apple and a trustee of the Wikimedia Foundation as well. He's also the author of 15 books, such as The Art of Start, The Art of Social Media, Enchantment, and so many more. These books are textbooks, if you will, for the finest academic institutions in the world. His writing focuses on tactical and practical matters in order to empower and inspire. Lastly, Guy is also a speaker, giving over 50 keynote speeches a year to his clients such as Apple, Nike, Audi, and Google. Guy, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you say hi?
Hello. Hi. It's fun to be here. Thanks for access to your listeners.
And again, this is actually round two of our little recording because the previous recording really screwed up. So I really, really appreciate Guy taking the time to come and chat with us. But let's get into it, because I know you're limited here. What made you, I know the podcast is something, is what you say is your true calling and your true passion, but what really made you start the podcast? Why did you start it?
There are two reasons why I started my podcast. One was that I was on a road trip, a PR trip, for my latest book. This is 4 years ago now, called Wise Guy. And so I was talking to business podcasters all the time, and I got around to asking them, so how does podcasting work? Mm-hmm. And they told me that it's promotional and advertising based. So I asked them, well, how many ads do you sell? And they said three, one at the beginning, one in the middle, one at the end. And I asked them, how much do you sell those for? And he said, $15,000 for the first one, $10,000 for the second one, $5,000 for the last one. So, you know, I can add that up and get 30,000 and multiply by 52 and you get $1.5 million. And I said to myself, why am I writing books? I should become a podcaster. So that's one half of it. The other half of it is that I'm at the end of my career, and now I have sort of the critical mass, I think, to be a great podcaster, which is access to people, the foundational knowledge to ask them good questions, and the ability to actually articulate those questions and get those answers out. So if you drew those three circles, I think when I'm one of the few people in the middle of all three circles, or the intersection of the three circles.
If you draw a Venn diagram, you're the center.
I don't know about I'm the center, but I'm in the center. I wouldn't say I'm the only person in the center.
Right. Well, I must say so myself. I think your podcast is very, very insightful, and it gives a lot of wisdom that you kind of, I said this before, you don't get it elsewhere. So I really appreciate what you've been able to generate and create.
Thank you. Thank you. It's, you know, I just interviewed an author of a book called Ikigai, and Ikigai is a Japanese word that describes sort of your calling in life, your reason for existence. And, you know, until I had never heard the term. I'm Japanese, and I never heard the term until a few months ago. And that truly has defined my relationship with podcasting. I was searching for a concept, and that is the concept. Podcasting is my ikigai.
So I was actually going to ask you, what is your ikigai? Because I know you had mentioned it in one of your TED Talks. And personally, that's one of my favorite books. I love that book. So I'm definitely going to listen to that episode. What did you learn from the interview with the author?
Well, I never read or heard someone so accurately describing how I felt about something. So it's just clarification, shall I say, on what I'm trying to do.
For those who don't know, can you tell us a little bit about what Ikigai is?
Well, it is this calling in life that, you know, if you ask Jane Goodall, what's her Ikigai? It is, you know, saving the earth, probably.
Yeah.
And so my Ikigai is not nearly as grand as that. So it's truly, it's your calling in life. So You know, I don't know if you have an ikigai yet. You're kind of young to have an ikigai. Don't sweat it. It'll come.
Eventually, I hope. I definitely don't think I found it yet.
Well, I guarantee you at your age, when I was your age, I wasn't even close to it.
What were you doing at our age or at my age?
How old are you?
17.
I was playing football.
Oh, what happened to football? No more?
No, not at 68.
Surfing, right?
Yeah.
So taking it a little bit towards your upbringing and your family, tell us a little bit, what role does family play in your life now?
Well, I would say that, you know, there's podcasting in my life, there's Canva in my life, there's surfing in my life, and there's family in my life. And truly, those are the only things that matter to me. Truly. Right. Like 2/3 of my life is over. So I gotta spend my time wisely at this point.
There's still a long road ahead. And I think with all of your work, it's been so amazing and it's been so impactful in so many different ways that you have this foundation that you can only build on, right? So, I mean, it's really inspiring seeing you start something like this at 60. Well, the podcast, at least.
Let's just say that I've been podcasting for about 3 years now, and not that many people take up something that late in life at 65. Usually that's, you know, that's when you start sitting in a couch watching Fox all day. Right. Not me.
No, but you know what? I'm inspired by that. And I love that, because going back to the whole ikigai principle, what they talked about was that Japanese people live for so long because they are continuously active, you know, and that's active in their minds and their bodies. Like,
well, I'm Japanese. I'm active in my mind. I'm active in my body. I don't know if my diet is exactly the Okinawan diet, but for my podcast, I have 52 episodes a year. That not every guest has a book, but most of them do. So I probably read 40 to 50 books a year. And so I have to understand a lot of things to do a good interview.
Yeah.
So there's about 3 or 4 hours of prep for each interview. And my interviews are very diverse. So, you know, I'm interviewing 1 week the whistleblower in the Theranos case. And then I'm interviewing someone who was president of a seminary. And then I'm interviewing someone who has ALS and is running marathons all over the country. And then I'm interviewing Gretchen Carlson, who took down Roger Ailes at Fox. And then I'm interviewing the author of Ikigai. So it's not like I have a sports podcast, so I only need to understand, you know, Tom Brady.
Yeah.
I did interview Kerry Walsh Jennings, by the way, as the, you know, greatest women's volleyball player. So I need to understand volleyball and, you know, Ikigai and this Andrew Zimmern, the chef. So I need to understand a lot of different things. So if intellectual stimulation prevents dementia, I will never get dementia. If you
do this for the rest of your life, I mean, well, then it begs the question. Yeah, but it's amazing, you know, and it's, I feel like in the American society, we kind of have this notion of like, all right, stop, retire at 65 and just chill, you know? But like, what does chilling mean? Until you die, you're just sitting there. Like, what is that really? How is that helpful to you, to society, to the people around you? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it could be that theory of retire at 65 happened because your body was just worn out from doing manual labor.
Right.
So, you know, my body is not worn out from working on a factory floor 10 hours a day or working in a coal mine. So, you know, that's a key difference.
Yeah. And I think we're slowly, as we transition to this age of information and the age of, you know, our minds more so than our bodies, we're going to see just lives extend.
Well, although, you know, I could make the bizarre case that with things like ChatGPT, and this is just the beginning of AI.
Oh,
pretty
yeah.
Soon, yeah, pretty soon, or maybe our brains won't be active too. So,
well, that's true too. That's really true. But then I just read a study that I forgot his name. He's a tech exec. He sold his company to, I don't know if it was, I think it was Google, but he is doing everything in his power to reverse aging. So he's a 44-year-old in an 18-year-old body now because of all the different things that he's doing to reverse his aging.
Yeah, and you know, and this is the guy who spends $2 million a year doing this or something.
Yeah.
So, I got to tell you, I don't know him personally. I don't really know what he's doing, but just conceptually, you know, billionaires trying to preserve their body and preserve their life, you know, for the betterment of society. There's something very narcissistic about that. You know? Like,
yeah.
I can guarantee you I'm not spending $2 million preserving my body. I'm not going to freeze my body. I'm not going to do anything like that. Okay? So when it's time, I'm going. That's it. It's that simple. And this concept, I mean, that is just, you know what? You are so important and so valuable to the world. You have to live immortally. Yeah. Nobody's. We're all just specks of dust.
In the grand scheme of things, with the way the world is going right now, global warming, there's ice in Texas. I mean, it finally snowed in New York after, like, I think it was a record-breaking 50 years that it was that we hadn't seen snowfall in this long. So, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, we may not even be here in 7 years. Who knows?
Well, yeah. Well, don't get too depressed. But yeah, I mean,
well, yeah,
I have a point.
You know, I feel like there's also that we overlook the world and what it's giving us. But if we can't nurture it, then, you know, there's nothing that it can give back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were there any personal shifts that developed in you that helped you be the passionate, happy, hardworking person that you are today?
Well, you know, I don't have one of these made for movie stories where I immigrated to the United States with just a bag, and you know, I had to suffer, and I overcame dysfunction and family, or you know, pain or suffering. I'm very, very, very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth, but I wasn't born into, you know, oppressing poverty either.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So no one's going to make a movie about my life. There's just not that much drama in it. But basically, I've been very lucky and I work very hard. That's a good combination. When you're lucky and you work hard, good things happen.
But I think there's something special in that this isn't necessarily a made-for-movie story, right? You worked hard and you had your own circumstances, but what did you make of those circumstances?
Well, I made a lot. I mean,
right.
You know, I worked for Apple. I was the second software evangelist for Apple. I started some companies. I worked for the Motorola division of Google. I am the chief evangelist of Canva for now almost 9 years, and Canva has definitely dented the universe and changed the world, democratizing design. And I had four kids.
When you think back on your life, right? When you think back on your childhood, when you think back on your developing years, really, were there any moments that you can look back on where you're like, wow, that was really impactful and that changed, whether it was your perspective, your relationships, your outlook?
I mean, absolutely, there were moments like that, but not...
What were they?
Not drama. Not like, you know...
What were
I
the,
was
what...
deported from Japan or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, one is...
Yeah.
An elementary school teacher convinced my parents to take me out of the public school system and put me in a college prep school in Hawaii. That changed the arc of my life.
Yeah. Or
when I landed at Stanford, because of that school, that changed the arc of my life too. I left Hawaii. If I had stayed in Hawaii, I would have had a very different life. So I go to Stanford. My eyes are open to what people can accomplish and, you know, just how big the world is.
Mm-hmm.
Then I meet somebody at Stanford who eventually got me the job in the Macintosh division. He changed the arc of my life. And so now, but listen, I'm writing a book right now called The Remarkable Mindset. And one of the things I've observed is that you can only connect those dots looking backwards. As you're in it, you cannot look forward and predict, you know. So 40 years from now, you may look back and say, you know, I listened to Guy on that podcast and he told me to do this. So I did that. That led to that. That led to that. And that led to where I am. But right now, you have no idea. You have literally no idea of which dots are going to connect. So that's an important lesson. Well, my take on that is that you got to paint a lot of dots because you don't know which ones are going to connect.
Which ones do you think, or which ones have you found were the ones that, looking back, connected the most? Were they the ones that you kind of just let happen serendipitously, or were they the ones that you planned strategically and, you know, cultivated?
I've done very little strategic planning with my life. I went from things that interested me to things that other things that interested me. So I can look back and I can reinvent the plan to fit what happened, but I cannot tell you there was a plan. It's not like I said, oh, so I'm going to go to private school. From private school, I'm going to go to Stanford. Stanford, I'm going to major in psych because I'm going to become an evangelist, marketeer, and salesperson. I do that. And then I'm going to find a hot startup in Sydney that's democratizing, you know, graphics. And then I'm going to discover podcasting. Oh, and along the way, I'm going to write 15 books. There was no plan like that.
There was no plan.
None at all.
And I think that's what I really wanted to get at here, because people, I feel like we're stuck in this loop of this is how it's going to go. It's going to go like this. We're going to do it this way. And then we don't put our hands up and leave room for just letting life happen, right?
Well, I mean, I know, you know, you're in a college application process, right?
Yeah.
So let's say, worst case, you don't get accepted to Stanford. Okay?
Fair.
Because you may think, your parents may think that the key to your life is getting accepted at Stanford. Because once you get to Stanford, you get the degree, you know, you meet the right people, you know, you're the next Steve Jobs. But let's say you don't get into Stanford. So what does that mean? Does that mean you're a failure? Does that mean that you'll never be happy? Not at all. And you'll only know this looking backwards. Maybe getting into Stanford would be the worst thing ever for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just don't know it right now.
You don't.
Yeah.
And your parents don't know it. Nobody knows it.
Did you ever deal with that? Not.
Well, I mean, after Stanford, I went to law school for 2 weeks and quit. At the time, I thought, what a tragic mistake. But looking back, didn't matter at all. In fact, looking back, that was one of the smarter things I did. But at the time, I had a lot of doubt about that decision.
You did. You did. Did you ever deal with perfectionism?
It depends on the connotation you attach to that world. So am I a perfectionist? Yes. I like when I write, I probably do things that writers and certainly with podcasters, nobody does what I do.
Nobody, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Very few people do what I do. So with my writing, you know, I'll do things like I'll search for every word that ends in L-Y because I think adverbs are weak. I'll search for every word B-E because I'm trying to eliminate the passive voice. I look for all those kind of things. I want to eliminate adjectives, you know, and I look for every instance of the word very. When people say it was a very dark night, that's bullshit. What does very dark mean? So you have to find a better way to describe very dark. Hmm. And so I do those kinds of things. And when I write a book, I'm in the process of writing a book right now. I have been working for months on just the outline. I haven't even started writing it. And it's been months of working on the outline.
Yeah.
I don't think most people spend months working on their outline.
No.
Maybe I should just put it all in ChatGPT and see what it says. But anyway.
You know what? That is not a bad idea. You can bounce off of it. Definitely. I mean, it's not a bad idea. I know I told you before, the college essay video, they actually produced something interesting. Listen, it took a couple of tries, but it got there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's as simple as, you know, ChatGPT, write my Stanford essay.
Yeah.
Although it could do that. But I think if you did something that general, it will come back and it'll cite, you know, four or five factors about why Stanford, right?
Yeah.
But it may be that one of those factors is something you never thought of. That, you know, you had a passion for tech. So ChatGPT says one reason why Stanford is because you want to be in Silicon Valley and, you know, in the computer science department where Google and Yahoo and, you know, all those other tech companies started, because to you, that's the center of the universe because you're a techie. Maybe that didn't occur to you as a reason.
Right.
Although, you know.
I mean, yeah.
So you never know. You never know.
And I think that goes with, you know, life, people, everything, and everyone you meet and see too, right? You meet someone in the street and you never know how they're going to impact you and change the course of your life, which goes back to what you were saying before. You can only connect the dots going back. So it's always worth a shot, really, right?
Well, again, you know, you need a lot of dots.
You need a lot of dots. You need a lot of dots. What? Well, your father, Duke Kawasaki, he was a lot of different things. He was a fireman. He was a real estate broker. He was a senator. He was a government official. But as
very good research.
But he was very hardworking to have done all those things, right?
He was. That's for sure. Yes.
What did you witness in those days? And what were there lessons? Were there moments in seeing how he worked in his life that you were like, wow,
well,
and served as a catalyst for you?
Listen, I didn't think about it that way when I saw it, but he definitely reinvented himself, right? So he went from fireman to real estate broker to politician to government official.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's four or five different careers right there, which is kind of similar to me. Maybe it's in my DNA.
That's exactly what
so,
it is.
Yeah. But I can't tell you that I saw that and I knew what I was seeing when I saw it. He was just my father. So, and I also, he had a real passion for music, which I don't have at all. Way into his adult, you know, life, he was still doing things like that. He didn't just sit on the couch and watch Fox all day.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That too may be in my DNA.
I think it is. I think it is. It comes exactly like when you think about it. I was like, oh, wow. Only yours is just in a completely, it's in a different fashion, right?
Yeah.
We're looking now, looking back, I'm going to ask you the same kind of question. How do you think seeing that impacted you?
Well,
how do you think seeing his transitions, maybe even subconsciously?
Well, you know, like I said, it, when it was happening, I didn't know what was happening. I, you know, it's only now, literally right now, as I think about it, because you brought it up, that he has had a career that is just as, you know, peripatetic as mine. Mm. But I can't tell you that when I was 19, I looked at what he did and said, that's what I'm going to do. That's not true.
Of course. Yeah.
It just happened to come out that way.
It happened. It's interesting, though, to see how that, seeing that kind of probably subconsciously impacted you, because it's kind of the same way your course or your life has played out, right?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think your father, in your TED Talk, you talked about this upper right-hand corner, which really stuck with me. Your father was clearly in the upper right-hand corner, right? He was very valuable. He did a lot of things. He was influential, well, influential in several different ways. But what are ways that you can get to the upper right-hand corner? And how do you think you got to the upper right-hand corner?
Well, you know, the magic quadrant, as it's called, the upper right-hand corner. It's kind of the entire subject of my book, this Remarkable Mindset book. And I think there are basically four elements. Mm. So element number one is growth. Growth meaning you have a growth mindset that, you know, things are not laid in granite. You can learn new skills. You can improve. You can change. So there's the growth mindset. The second element is that you have guts. You have got to do things risky. You have to open yourself up for vulnerability. You got to have guts to be remarkable. The third element is grit, that you need to work very hard. And the fourth element is grace, that you have a sense of taking the higher road, that you want to make the world a better place. So if you have grace and grit and guts and growth, you pretty much will be remarkable.
The three or four G's, they're all G. And your guy, oh my God. Was that on purpose?
Yeah, it's all planned.
That's actually so interesting. I'm going to ask you one more question and then we can start wrapping it up. But I know one of your hobbies is surfing, and I think it's, you know, your dad had singing and music, but maybe yours is surfing, right? That same kind of passion. But touching back on those little things in life, what does surfing give you? What does surfing allow you to do?
So late in my life, at 60, I took up surfing. At 44, I also took up ice hockey. So very late in my life, I took up two very difficult things.
Yes.
And I did it because I fell in love. Just like I fell in love with Canva, just like I fell in love with Macintosh, I fell in love with hockey and I fell in love with surfing. And, you know, I think Carol Dweck would tell you that I truly personify a growth mindset. Mm-hmm. Because
I love that book.
When I took up surfing at 60, you know, when I tell, I meet people all the time who are 30, 35, and I say, you should try surfing. It is a beautiful sport. And they say, well, I'm too old. I'm like, you know, I can't even understand that. So like, I'm telling you, you're 35. You're too old to take up surfing. Why don't you wait 25 more years and then take up surfing? Because that's what I did. So don't give me any bullshit about you're too old.
Right.
And so, you know, that's a mindset. That it never occurred to me at 44, you're too old to take up hockey, having never skated. And it never occurred to me at 60 that you're too old to take up surfing. So That's the lesson there. Now, I can't tell you I ever became a great hockey player or I ever will become a great surfer, but I bet you I'm one of the best surfers who took up surfing at 60.
60. Exactly. And you know what? It's all about, you say this, I love this quote from you. Go with your interests, not your passions, or follow your interests, not your passions.
Yes. And people might want to know what the hell is the difference.
Yes.
Well, I think that there's so much pressure from maybe authors and self-help gurus that you got to find your passion, your ikigai, yep. really. But, you know, finding your passion or your ikigai is a very difficult thing. And I would say that I found it maybe 3 or 4 times in 68 years. But there seems to be this concept that, you know, at 18, you should have found your passion. And, you know, you look around and you say, God, I'm 18. I don't have my passion yet. And, you know, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
Everybody else at Stanford has their passion already figured yep. out. Well, they're faking it. So I think that the passion test is too high a bar, that you're supposed to find this thing immediately, fall in love, and, you know, it become your reason for existence. What I think the way the world works is you find things interesting. So podcasting may interest you, surfing may interest you, hockey may interest you, math may interest you, violin may interest you. So as you go through life, you'll find many interests. You should pursue those interests. Maybe one of them will become your passion. But to say that, oh no, it would be, to use a dating analogy, if you go through life saying, I've got to find the perfect spouse.
Yeah.
Rather, you should just date a lot of people and maybe one of them will turn into the perfect spouse. But to think you're going to rifle shot and find the perfect spouse, I think is poor reasoning.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like what you said, and I've really been trying to follow that, because I think we're, like you said, we're just put into a box. And so it's always, oh, what's your major? You know, we're kind of forced into it now, but hit undeclared, you know, like, just, I don't know, because you're going to see, right? You wait and see, explore your interests. I feel like that's what life should be about, not necessarily.
Especially at your age.
Yeah, definitely. In life. All right, Guy.
I hope you guys enjoy today's episode. And Guy, thank you so, so much for coming and being so willing to chat with us twice. I really, really encourage you guys to check out the Remarkable People podcast and all of Guy's work. I will link as much as I can possibly find in the show notes. His TED Talk, too, was super, super informational and insightful. So definitely, definitely check all of that out as well. He's interviewed phenomenal people, including Jane Goodall. So I'll definitely have that linked in the show notes as well, so you guys can access it. But aside from that, I just want to thank you profusely for coming and listening. And I want to thank Guy profusely for coming and chatting with us. I hope you guys have an amazing week, and I will see you next week for another episode. Bye.